We got a head nod. Okay, you got yours?
Sure. I was up in Champaign, Illinois over the weekend. I lived there about 40 years ago and just noticed that growth around the university has been fairly modest compared to what's happened around the Triangle. And yet they have a great university for engineering and sciences and all. Would you have any comments on why an area like Champaign-Urbana would not take off and yet we see such tremendous growth in around our universities here?
Well, I'd like to think it's because they stole one of our best people recently. And that's kind of, no, that is a great question. And you could have a whole cafe on that topic. And it's basically said, a lot of times when you talk about technology and science and engineering as catalysts for the economy, the first thing that region will say is we need a university. We have to have a research university, and that is what is going to do it. And if we could have a research university, that would do it. Now, in fact, research universities are important in vigorous, dynamic technological economies. I mean, if we look at Boston and San Jose and the Research Triangle, Austin, these are all Madison, Seattle, these are all places that have active, large research universities and programs. But there are also places like Champaign-Urbana have a very active, large, and engaged research university and no technology cluster around it. And in fact, that is the norm. You do not see active technology environments and economies without universities, but you see a lot of them where they have those universities and there's no technology economy, which begs the question that universities are catalysts. They are not the drivers. And that's underscored by the fact if you look at a place like Boston, 9 research extensive universities in Boston. And you say, my God, those universities are churning out huge numbers of companies. And the reason that 128 is such a dynamic technology environment must certainly be because you've got those universities. Well, in fact, if you look at the number of spin-outs that come out of the universities, it's 4% of the total that are created in Boston in any given year. 4%. So the universities are not the fundamental drivers. They're not out leading that process. What they are, however, is the catalyst of the process. They're creating the basic intellectual property and resources that eventually drive an economy. But that is a long-term thing. That's not a short-term and tactical impact. Where the real economic benefit comes from having a capacity to absorb the activities of the university. So it's a critical mass issue in the environment surrounding the university. There's a social scientist who's got a great name. He's from Romania. His name is Attila Varga. I can always remember because any guy who publishes under the name Attila has got... And how can you argue with this? You can't argue with it. And he published a work in the early 2000s looking at metropolitan areas and this issue. And he said, okay, if you make $100 million of investment in basic research in Boston, in Madison, in Champaign, in Kansas City, and you know, in other words, of metropolitan areas of different sizes with functionally equivalent research universities, what's the outcome? And he found it was almost entirely the economic outcome of that was almost entirely correlated with the size of the economy that surrounded it, not the university's size. It's very possible to have a $1 billion research institution sitting in a field somewhere with no technology economy around it. What it makes it possible are the things that couple it to the local economy. That makes sense?
Okay, one here.
Hi, North Carolina seems to be a place where more people retire. Do you have any knowledge of how we rank as a state, and how might that influence our future economy as especially we boomers retire?
Well, I have some kind of rule, thumbnail understandings of that. Of course, there's a tremendous amount of retirement activity in the mountains right now and in the coasts as well. As a result, I think what's interesting is Jackson County, which is where Silva and Cullowhee are, and it's north of Highlands and Cashers over in that part of the state. Jackson County now has one of the highest median house prices in North Carolina. So you're seeing economic indicators reflect the influx of people, not only retiring, but there are a lot of halfbacks moving back from Florida into North Carolina. They are largely residing on the coasts and in the and in the mountains. That is going to, and the rate at which that inflow is occurring is going to dramatically change the demographics of North Carolina over the next 25 years. And there's absolutely, it is going to have a profound impact. What that impact is, I think many people are still working on what that actually means with respect to our state. Clearly, the needs for social services, the needs for infrastructure, the needs for that the state has to provide in those areas is going to reflect the demographics of the population as it inflows. That didn't really satisfactorily answer your question, although I think this is an area that a lot of people are very concerned about because of the sheer attractiveness of North Carolina. I had a call, I was on a telephone yesterday, I had a call from one of these financial analysts out in San Jose, and he called me up and he said, you know, I've heard an awful lot about North Carolina. Everybody's talking about North Carolina out here, and I would really like to come to North Carolina and look and see what's going on there. I said, well, we would love to have you come out here, of course. But there is that growing perception of North Carolina as being a very attractive place. Interestingly, there was a, I don't know if you saw, there was an article on the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal this morning. On the editorial page, there was an editorial, a guest editorial, on this very phenomenon, and it said what a lot of regions have focused on in their economic development strategies is the creative class. If we will build enough bars and discos and interesting places, then the young innovative people will come. And that's true. But it also is true the minute they have children, they move out. And they go somewhere else. And of the four cities that they mentioned in this article, he said, they are moving away from places like Boston and San Jose, and they went there. And they are moving to places like Raleigh, Durham, and Charlotte. And I said, of this, we have two, you know, of all the nation, the two largest cities in North Carolina, the ones that he mentions as the places people are moving, that is a reflection of that. So we have that demographic, and I think that's going to be a powerful workforce because these are people in their, not only are we retracting and retaining people in their young years, but we're also, these are the people in their 30s and 40s who are highly vested, highly motivated, very productive, and value the things that North Carolina offers in terms of environment, place, infrastructure, as well as the technology economy.
Okay, one here.
We're hearing a lot about climate change these days, and it appears that we might be getting into a pattern of only having adequate rainfall during El Nino years with 3 or 4 years of drought in between. This obviously has implications for our economy down the road if this pattern continues. I'd like to think there's some planning going on about this sort of thing, of how we might sustain through this. Is that happening?
There is. I think, and since a lot of that planning occurs on a regional or metropolitan basis, I think there are very various regions and various metropolitan districts that have done that type of planning to various degrees of success. I think the current situation that we're in now is certainly a wake-up call to those that have not, and a clarion call for more complete and considered planning for these long-term. But yes, it is an area that a number of people in the administration are working on and looking at. How do we, from a state level, help assist municipalities and local governments with their planning? Because, you know, the Cary water supply is the purview of the Cary city government, the Raleigh water supply, the Chapel Hill water supply. These are metropolitan. These are metropolitan resources.
Down front here.
Where does North Carolina stand as far as the amount of venture capital that comes into the state, and a related question is, how is that related to and where is our position for startup industries? Because it seems to me, I look in the paper and there are some guys starting up some crazy new funny company just about every day.
Two questions there. One about the venture capital industry. The level of venture capital investment in North Carolina is competitive nationally. We typically rank, in terms of the dollar invested, we typically rank somewhere fifth in the country among U.S. states. But that actually is somewhat misleading because venture capitalists, and I remember when I was doing investment, we would see, I can't tell you how many business plans I would see would come in and say, well, year one, we're going to have $4 of revenue. Year two, we're going to have $8 of revenue. Year three, we're going to have $12 of revenue. And year four, we're going to have $8.7 million of revenue. Because the miracle is going to occur somewhere between year three and year four that's going to make us cash flow positive and going to win. And then we're going to be $800 million in year five. And so you would always see these graphs that we used to call the hockey stick. You know, they would go like this and they would just go like that. There are very few real hockey sticks in business, but there is one, and that's venture capital investment. And when you look at the distribution of venture capital investment in the United States, it looks like that. And the that part is California and Massachusetts. I mean, there is more venture capital investment in one county in California than there is in like 40 U.S. states combined. It is amazing the amount of money that is actually invested and put in play in San Jose and in San Diego. It is just tremendous. Whereas the level of investment in venture capital, in early stage investment in North Carolina will be something like $300 to $500 million on a good quarter. The level of investment in a quarter in venture capital in San Jose will be something of order $2.1 billion. So these are really disparate measures, and in fact, rankings in those cases don't mean a lot. Venture capital is... So we have large funds, and we have a large pools of venture capital in the state, but they tend to be large funds, pooled in large funds, and they tend to be domain specific. So you'll have a large fund that's invests only in biotechnology, for example. But I think that if we can solve the second part of your question, the opportunity presented by the second part of your question, it actually fixes the first part. Because venture capital, I firmly believe, is a lagging indicator. It's not a leading indicator. Personally, as a matter of personal philosophy, I would not, you know, I don't necessarily advocate that we create large pools of venture capital as a seed for some activity because venture capital investment follows opportunity. And as a venture capitalist, I never saw a great deal that didn't go funded. Because after all, venture capitalists are in the business of making money from funding great deals. So they will follow those deals. But admittedly, there is a somewhat of a chicken and an egg issue here. You have to have a certain level of activity to generate that interest. Where we have an opportunity as a state is actually in your second question, and that speaks to the level of entrepreneurial business creation in North Carolina. Now, given the size of our research institutions and the research economy in North Carolina, the 16 university system of North Carolina generates a little over $1 billion in sponsored programs research every year. That is a very competitive figure. By contrast, MIT and its affiliated institutions is somewhere between $600 and $700 million. So if you combine NC State sponsored programs research levels and UNC Chapel Hills, you have an MIT and then some. So the level of research that's occurring in this area is really dramatic. What we have yet to seize completely on is the opportunity to convert that in spin-outs and startup activities. Our business creation rate is not as high as it should be given the size of our research institutions. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that. Perhaps capital is one of them, but I think there are other structural issues and reasons why that might be so.
Do we need Carolina North? It seems to me we have so many research facilities. Do we need another large, potentially large, research facility?
I hope they're not coming after my car. You would ask that question. I will answer the question with a question, and that is that we talked a moment ago about the impact of universities on economies and the fact that the creation of intellectual property is the first step in a chain of events that must occur if we are to realize economic outcome from that investment. Now the state spends a tremendous amount, and it spends it wisely, on higher education and basic research capacity. And we have created this research capacity. When we look outside of North Carolina and we look at other universities that are very successfully commercializing innovation in the university and making it and bridging that gap between the university and the economy. Because after all, when you say, what is an economic outcome? The economic outcome is jobs, wealth creation, improved economic standard of living for the citizens of North Carolina. That's the outcome that we're ultimately talking about when we talk about company creation. We're talking about innovation, improvement of human condition, all of those things. That is a translation of what goes on in the universities and in research communities into the private sector. That is not part of the typical mission of a university. University's mission is education and research. Those are the things that the university is functioned in line to do. When you look at a university like MIT, and it produces a tremendous number of new companies, MIT will produce in a year, will spin out 35 to 45 companies in a year, MIT. UNC Chapel Hill and NC State combined, 7 to 10. Similar size research institutions. That begs the question then, why? And when you look at a university like MIT, what it's paid particular attention to are the institutions and the structures that bridge across the gap. They have the Deshpande Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. They have research institutions like the Whitehead and the Broad that sit adjacent to the campus, whose purpose is to fund basic research but also to move it translationally into applications. The Centennial Campus on NC State was a national model and is a national model for exactly this kind of institution, this bringing together the public and the private sector. On any given day at NC State Centennial Campus, you can walk in a hallway and see people who are university faculty mixing and working with directly scientists and researchers from engineers from the private sector. That is the vision behind Carolina North as well. And so if you ask, is it important that we create these institutions? Absolutely. Isn't it important that we create things that address that opportunity in creating more companies and creating more derivative economic impact from the investments that we're already making in technology? I would say absolutely. The specific form of Carolina North and how it interacts with the Chapel Hill, you know, with the citizens of Chapel Hill and how they want to particularly fashion it, that's in their purview. But the need is real for creating these bridging institutions.
Another one down front.
Yes, you had talked about how small are the careers that children go into later on in terms of the scientific community compared to other countries. So, I have a high school student, so I know that has not been a big concept for my daughter to go into these fields, and we're bringing a lot of people in from other states and other countries. How are we doing in terms of making science and math more exciting for our younger children, that they would be excited to go into these fields and grow into it in North Carolina?
We're doing better, but we have a long way to go. And the reason is this. What's interesting about science and technology, think about this for a minute. This is an interesting difference. I'm actually intrigued by this difference. A career in science and technology or engineering, or mathematics, the STEM disciplines, although in most cases in in high schools and in our public education and in our primary and secondary system, we really don't do STEM. We do more SM. You know, there's not so much of the engineering type education. It's mostly science, some technology and mathematics. But for careers in science, technology, and math, when you're a child in coming up through the education process, these are actually careers that you very, very early on in your educational career, very early on, not high school, not even junior high, but before junior high, like sixth, seventh grade, you have to actively reserve the option to have that career later in life. Because these are careers that are hierarchical in nature. You cannot be a mathematician without calculus. You cannot be proficient in calculus without trigonometry and algebra. You cannot be proficient in trigonometry and algebra without basic arithmetical skills. So if you can, any place along that path, you opt out. You actually opt out of a career path. And what we see in practice is kids are making, very often when we focus on science and technology, we say, well, we need to improve the science and technology curricula in our high schools. And that's true. That's absolutely true. But we're not losing them in the high schools. We're actually losing them in the sixth grade. That's where they're making the decision. And they're making the decision not affirmatively. They're not saying, I do not want to be a scientist. Because I prefer to do this. They're making it in the negative. They are culling a career path. They are saying, science and math is too hard. I'm not good at it. And so I'm not going to pursue it. So when they get to high school, they haven't had the algebra. They haven't had the algebra 2. They haven't had the trig. And they can't do the calculus. So they have excluded a career path. I see these students all the time at UNC Chapel Hill. I see in our elite public institution, I see students that come to me, I am not good in science and math. Therefore, that's supposed to be an absolute. I am not, you're asking me to do science and math. I am not good at science and math. Therefore, I should not be expected to do this. Our economy, our world, our existence is increasingly linked to proficiency and understanding of science and technology, even if you aren't going to be a science and technologist. You know, I have to, this is not by way of, I have this device here. And it's a, as the science and technology person, it's a source of tremendous pride. I have a device here in my hand that does emails. It's a phone. It's a contracts, of course, we all have that. Calendar. It is a 12-channel GPS. It is a music player. It plays movies. It does instant communication. It browses the World Wide Web either over the wireless network or through, is there a Wi-Fi network here? I can log onto that as well. It does active voice recognition, so I don't even have to dial, I just talk at it. And it was designed in Asia. Now, this is a perfect example of the type, this is now. The first computer that I had, I was talking to a group of undergraduate researchers. The first computer I had was one that I made, and it had enough wire in it to go to the moon and back. And I spent 9 months soldering it, and it did 4 arithmetic calculations very badly. And here I sit some few years later with a device in which GPS is a function. Now, GPS represents the application, the technology embodiment of general relativity theory, space and time. And this device uses it casually to tell me where I am on the Earth. This is the world in which we are now raising 6th, 7th, and 8th graders to be competitive in. And we are permitting them to get to sixth grade and say, well, I'm just not good at math and science. We cannot tolerate this as a nation. We can't tolerate it as a state. We can't tolerate it as parents. We just simply can't. We are permitting whole segments of our school population to opt out. And that we simply can't do.
Okay, one in the back. And then we'll have one more in the front. And I think we'll kind of bring it to a close unless someone's really screaming and waving their hands, and I'll get the microphone to them.
Yeah. Do you personally identify with the idea that the pendulum may very well have swung on the production of clean energy? And if you do, what's going on? By that I mean not just the belief that it's morally correct, but it appears as though it's just about to be financially the right thing to do. What is our state doing in regards to that, and where do you stand?
Well, I do. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of this, there is, of course, the as you say, there is a you know, kind of the moral imperative to live, I believe, more sustainable lifestyles. But there's also the economic imperative, and I think at the end of the day, it's the economic imperative that makes many of the alternative energy technologies that we've talked about actually economically viable. Now, that being said, I think, and this is musings, this is a non-official statement. This is the musings of a person, okay, one of you. This is not a position in any way, shape, or form. But one of the things that strikes me is, you know, when I read this, like this little tidbit, the city of Beijing alone in China is adding 30,000 cars each month. Now, when I read statistics like this, I see that we've actually done a very good job as a nation in selling a model. And not as a state, but as a nation. We are, what, 5% of the world's population? And we consume, what, 25% of the world's resources? Now, if the rest of the developing world is, in fact, aspiring to a similar standard of living, simple arithmetic will say that that is not a sustainable model. You cannot, if 5% are taking 25% and the rest of the 95% want to take their 25% shares, that's not a sustainable model over the long term. So somewhere along the way, the economic imperatives become overwhelming to shift away from what we have now is essentially an extractive economy to a more sustainable model. And what that model eventually takes has to incorporate these types of alternative energy. Because in very real sense, energy is the currency of economic growth, especially in the developed world. And so what is North Carolina doing? Well, North Carolina is grappling with these problems like all states are. In fact, this week I was involved in the creation of the guidelines and the solicitation for North Carolina's first green and renewables alternative energy incentive fund for small businesses in North Carolina to incent and to fund the creation of alternative energy technologies. Last year in the budget, we passed one of the most aggressive renewable portfolio standards in the country. Last year in the budget, we created the North Carolina Biofuel Center, which is now open in North Central North Carolina. There are a number of initiatives. There was a strategic plan for biofuels and alternative energies created last year that helped guide the legislative basis for some of these activities. So there is activity, and there's a lot of activity. But I think we're really only in the very early stages, and we're starting to see the economic imperative. I was in Munich not too long ago and was reeling at $7.50 a gallon gasoline. And some of that was the euro, but much of that was just the base price of gas. And that will have, I don't know if that answered your question, but I think that will have...
That's a driver. That's
fundamental driver.
Yeah. Okay, last one.
Recently I was on a campus in the lobby of a school, and they had a board with representation of all the members of the school body, They showed something like 198 from India. They had 196 from the USA. They had 180-something from China. Kind of going back to your question about Americans being allowed to opt out, or the youth being opting out of STEM disciplines, it seems to me that in these other competing nations, Asia and the rising giants, they seem to be highly competitive, highly motivated, in fact, maybe straitjacketed. We talk here about forcing science and STEM down kids' throats and them they're rejecting it. But it seems to be much harder or much more authoritarian in those other countries. So what's happening here? What are we doing wrong? Why are we letting them opt out where the other competitors are sticking with it, teaching the tests, all that kind of thing? What's going on?
I mean, there's a cultural component to this, of course, but there's actually two pieces to your question. One is the observation that a large number of graduate students in the United States are foreign nationals, and in fact, somewhere between half and two-thirds are foreign nationals in the technical disciplines. One of the things that strikes me is, I have to say this, and I will just be blunt, our immigration policy with respect to foreign graduate students is nuts. It is just simply nuts. Here we have students from all over the world aspiring to come to the United States, and a fundamental certification that they have to make in order to get a visa to study, to do graduate level study in the United States. And I am not making this up. I couldn't make this up. They have to attest and swear on their visa application that they will not stay in the United States after graduation. And they actually have to prove that they have the resources to leave. We should have, I think we should have, and I'm being only slightly tongue-in-cheek in this, we should have a special division of the INS whose sole purpose is to staple green cards to the diplomas of foreign nationals coming off the stage at graduation at research university. I just don't get it. I don't get it. And I never have gotten that. I mean, that is an enormous source of energy, ingenuity, innovation, and talent for us. And we are squandering it. So many of those students that you saw on that board are actually going to have to leave by design, and that is nuts for us as a country. Now, the other path of your question is how do we get our students there? Why is only 33% of the student population U.S. nationals? Part of it is cultural. I mean, when you look at these numbers, you know, nine members of the Chinese senior government, the Politburo, eight are engineers and one is a geologist. They're all scientists. They're all engineers. They are emphasizing science and education policy throughout their educational structures and making that, and culturally, they're emphasizing that as a key to individual and state prosperity. That's one piece. But I think another piece is we are failing, critically failing, when it comes to providing the people resources in those critical periods in these students' educational development. Erskine Bowles is famous for saying, I think he said in his inaugural address, he looked at the one of his priorities as president of the system is to increase the number of science and technology education graduates. We have 15 colleges of education in North Carolina in the system, I believe, 15 colleges of education. From the years 2000 to 2005, the 15 colleges of education in North Carolina graduated 3 certified physics teachers. In 5 years in 15 colleges. I am qualified to teach at the university. I have taught at Harvard. I have taught at Dartmouth. I have taught at UNC. But I am not qualified to teach science in primary and secondary education. I'm qualified to teach them once I graduate, but I'm not qualified to teach. We have to fundamentally rethink those types of policies and institutions. And that's my personal opinion. That's not an institutional opinion. I think we have to really fundamentally rethink how we populate the teaching ranks of early grades to you know, I have actually seen this. I've been observers in classes where I have seen a teacher say, you know, you have an eighth grade class, and I have seen a teacher go, well, you know, I don't really understand that, and that's hard, that kind of thing. That is a terrible message that we communicate in those early ages, and we are losing kids because of it. 60%. Our 12th grade graduating cohort is 60% smaller than they were when they entered ninth grade. I mean, I'm saying 40% smaller. That's 12th grade graduating cohort is 60% as large as the entering ninth grade cohort. We're losing 40%. We can't not tolerate that societally, culturally, from a matter of policy. We cannot tolerate that. We have to fix this. Well, I think that is part of it, certainly. But there's also other issues that go behind that. Preparation, investment, all those things.